When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.
Great news this week. The CDC announced that fully vaccinated people no longer have to wear masks or socially distance, except if you go to most places. Anyway, have fun out there.
Good morning and welcome to Morning Joe. It is Monday, May 17th. With us, we have White House reporter for the Associated Press, Jonathan Lemire, Washington anchor for BBC World News America, Katty Kay, and columnist and associate editor for The Washington Post, David Ignatius. And Joe, we've seen this confusion with masks. We went out. We actually went out to a place with people.
It doesn't happen.
I know.
Much. But, you know, so we traveled through. I traveled back yesterday and traveled through airports, huge, massive, cavernous airports without a lot of people in there. You got to put your mask on. Well, okay, what the CDC said,
right.
But okay.
People are being careful.
And in another state I went to, you go into one store, they said you have to have your mask on. The next store, you don't have to. So there needs to be some clarification here. And again, the only thing I've asked all along, I'm a simple country lawyer, as you know, just a plain, simple country lawyer. I just asked the Trump administration to follow the science. I'm asking the Biden administration to follow the science.
Well, they are.
And they are. Now I'm asking the state governors, follow the science, and also people that run their businesses, follow the science. I'm not asking for mosh pits inside of restaurants or inside of retail stores, but if the CDC is saying return to normal, and if the CDC is saying if you've been vaccinated, don't wear a mask, you don't have to wear a mask, and that should mean don't wear a mask. You know, there was a lot of virtue signaling from the right when they were, like, knocking down masks and doing asinine things while the CDC was saying not to. Now there's some virtue signaling. Obviously, it's on in an abundance of caution in some cases, but in other cases, it just doesn't make sense. You see people walking around wearing masks outside the size of, like, Massachusetts, and you're like, war is over if you want it.
I don't think it's the end of the world.
Well,
I'm still going to wear a mask.
People can wear
crowded areas.
Well, you have to wear a mask. By the way, you have. I said last week I was going to continue wearing masks on a plane, and there were some Luddites that were going crazy, saying, "Oh my God, he's wearing a mask." Well, that's a CDC requirement. There still are CDC requirements. And Scott Gottlieb said this yesterday. If we want to encourage people to get the vaccine, and we want to get people getting the vaccine, why, you ask? For the same reason we have our children get vaccines before they go to school. For the same reason, even though the likelihood of our children getting polio and diphtheria and measles is very low and rubella is very low, we still get that. Why? Because we want to keep herd immunity. We want to drive those diseases from the face of the earth. It's the same thing here. But if we want to encourage Americans to get the vaccine, as Dr. Scott Gottlieb said, then you got to lighten up when it comes to masks. If the science is there, and the science is there, the science is there, especially for outside. And yes, we are learning things as we move along. Because people say, well, why didn't they say this back in, like, December? Well, they didn't say it in December, Einstein, because they're still learning. They're still figuring this out. Why do you want to get a vaccine and wear a mask? If you, well, you know, you can still pass it along to other people. You're not going to get the effects of it yourself, though. You're going to be asymptomatic. So, again, the goal here is the same goal that doctors and scientists and epidemiologists have had for decades. Drive the number of people with vaccines up. Get it to a herd immunity. Whether it's kids, whether it's teenagers, whether it's adults, even if you're not looking at that person and what their reaction may be to the coronavirus, you're looking at them maybe getting it and passively passing it on to somebody who actually may have some underlying problems. Get the numbers up. And you get the numbers up, you get herd immunity, and this is behind us for good. And you don't have to worry about your loved ones who may not have gotten the vaccines for whatever reason.
But
again, as Scott Gottlieb said, for us to get there, we have to have a consistency when it comes to mask mandates. And people need to start listening to the CDC. If you're running a business, if you're running a state, if you're running a town, come on, lighten up and encourage people to go get the vaccine.
But Jonathan Lemire, the word from the White House has been very clear in terms of sort of loosening the mask mandate to understand the science. How are they employing it within the White House, and what are you hearing?
Well, certainly the White House itself was actually caught off guard by the CDC's, the timing of the CDC's announcement last week on masks, that only a few senior officials were given the heads up Wednesday night ahead of Thursday afternoon's public announcement. The president himself wasn't briefed until Thursday morning. And certainly that day, as word spread through the building, staffers took off their masks as they worked, whether they were inside their small offices. Reporters who had been fully vaccinated, who were in the building that day, myself included, we took our masks off as well. If you had completed the two-shot cycle and those 2 weeks after the second shot, not everyone has yet. And they believe that it is important to send the public image. We heard from the president that afternoon in the Rose Garden. He was exultant. It was probably the happiest he has been, aides say, since he came into office, really believing that that moment was signified the nation turning a corner on the pandemic. Now, to be clear, there's a long way to go still. They know there's pockets of the population that have been hesitant to get the vaccine. They need to convince them to do so. They know there are pockets of population that for one reason or another have had a hard time getting it. They need to improve their outreach to make sure that happens, even as we see the demand fall in states across the nation and pressure rise on the U.S. to export vaccines to other countries who are having that much more difficult of a time. They are indeed going to continue to follow the CDC. Criticize, perhaps, the CDC for moving too slowly on this in the past. And there's no doubt, and the White House has been sending signals about this, too, that they want clearer messaging as to who should be wearing a mask when. And, of course, this all relies somewhat, at least, on people in the honor system being candid about whether or not they've had the vaccine. And that's why we're seeing some places in these early days err on the side of caution and require people to still wear them.
We'll be talking a lot more about this, but we turn now to Israel's overnight launch of another barrage of airstrikes on Gaza. Israel says it destroyed 9 miles of Palestinian militant tunnels and the homes of 9 alleged Hamas commanders this morning. Gaza residents were awakened today by what's described as the heaviest attack since the conflict broke out a week ago. Meanwhile, Israeli residents are taking shelter as Palestinian rockets rain down on the country's southern cities. These latest attacks come after the deadliest day of violence yesterday. Rescue crews in Gaza were still combing through rubble last night, looking for survivors of a morning bombing where 3 buildings were hit over the course of 5 minutes. This while Israel's emergency service system reported direct hits in 2 major cities, including 1 to a synagogue. Israel says Hamas has fired nearly 3,000 missiles in their direction since last Monday. In a televised address yesterday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu insisted the attacks would continue at, quote, full force. The Gaza Health Ministry says at least 197 people have been killed since the violence began, including 58 children. Israel has reported 10 deaths, with 2 being children.
David Ignatius, you wrote about this movingly a few days ago. This is a nightmare. There's a cycle of violence that seems to continue every 4, 5, 6 years. And in this case, there are dark political overtones to this tragedy. And I am surprised that in the United States, which the United States coverage usually bends pro-Israel. I think we can all say that. Generally, it has through the years. There seems to be an agreement among most analysts and foreign policy leaders that this is a political crisis in part because The only two winners out of this are Benjamin Netanyahu and Hamas. And both of them, their credibility was strained on both sides. So as this tragedy continues and people continue to die disproportionately on the Palestinian side, but on both sides, there are tragedies on both sides. The only people winning from this politically are Netanyahu and Hamas.
I think that's the hardest part about this, Joe, is that civilians, as in every war I've ever covered, are the ones who pay the worst price. And that's happening on both sides with Palestinian civilians in Gaza. The numbers of dead and wounded are just terrible to read. And Israeli civilians, the attacks on Tel Aviv, the rocket attacks really upset Israelis. They felt that was crossing a red line. That's their major population center. I talked, Joe, to administration officials overnight to ask, what are they doing about this terrible tragedy? And the answer is what you'd expect, that they're working behind the scenes for a ceasefire. They know that as long as Prime Minister Netanyahu is determined to continue and try to get as much gain on the ground as he can, this is not likely to end. There are a lot of people in key positions who were around for the last Gaza war in 2014. That lasted 51 days. We're 1 week into this one. So there's a recognition this may take a while. There's a lot of talk in the administration about beginning to think about a post-conflict humanitarian reconstruction. I almost want to say a reset for Gaza. Gaza is one of the saddest places I've ever visited. It's just so many people packed together, so much suffering, people just trapped. Extremists seem to be the only political leaders that have any staying power in Gaza. So there's this hope that somehow over time you'd begin to get more responsible authorities in Gaza, get money to new groups. That was the hope back in 2014. Let's empower Egypt. Let's empower the Palestinian Authority. Let's bring the Palestinian moderates into Gaza to challenge Hamas. And you know what? It didn't work at all. But they're thinking right. Those same ideas again. But there's a recognition, Joe, that our ability to influence the situation now is very limited.
Well, David, that's striking considering how much money and aid we give to Israel. I'm surprised that I support that aid. So I've been pro-Israeli for my entire life, but we give them aid. And you say that Netanyahu is saying this is going to continue for some time. It's a no-win proposition if you support Israel and you support Israel standing not only in the Middle East but across the globe. It's a no-win proposition for them to claim they're going after a Hamas leader and kill 8 or 9 children. Say they're going after a Hamas leader or two or some offices and knock down the site where the Associated Press and Al Jazeera and other news agencies are reporting out of. That is a no-win proposition for the people of Israel. That is a no-win proposition for Israel diplomats across Europe and the globe. The only person that helps is Benjamin Netanyahu. Do we have no ability as a country to reach in and stop this senseless killing? Because there is no end game here. Everybody knows there is no end game here. Just more dead Palestinians and more dead Israeli citizens. While, as you've said before, Israelis and Arabs fighting inside of Israel now create a new dangerous dynamic.
Joe, I just make 2 points. I think it's entirely true that the powerless to affect these terrible events where there's so much human suffering. But the Israeli government feels when the rockets began to land on Israeli cities that an absolute harsh, punitive response was necessary, and it was necessary to degrade the infrastructure, the tunnels, the command and control that made that possible. So this is a scenario we've seen over and over. I do think Israelis make mistakes sometimes in their attempts to protect their security. I watched one of the biggest, I think, in modern history, the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982. I was a correspondent in Beirut watching the Israeli army roll in. And that created a nightmare. It essentially created Hezbollah as a political organization, created a security problem that continues to this day. So decisions that people make under pressure aren't always right. The problem, as somebody who's looked at the Middle East for so long, is that moderate opinion on which you could build a settlement that would last is getting shattered on all sides. The Palestinian Authority under Mahmoud Abbas is corrupt. It's weak. It was so weak it couldn't hold elections that were scheduled for this year because there were no moderates who'd win. They would simply have enfranchised the most extreme Hamas people in many areas. So somehow you've got to have something there to build on. And that's the work of years and decades. Unfortunately, during the Trump years, the U.S. checked out of that process. We gave up what had been an attempt to be the even-handed broker, the country that could talk to all sides. We gave that up. And I think Biden, Tony Blinken at State are trying to rebuild that, but it's going to take a while.
Well, and for people that are just tuning in and haven't been following this closely, this began with evictions in East Jerusalem. And then there were protests at one of the most sacred sites for Muslims. And there was a showdown there. Then Hamas. Well, and as David said, if you look at the Palestinian Authority, it's corrupt. You've got a leader that was elected to a four-year term now in his, 17th year. And reading from the New York Times this morning, Hamas has fired nearly 3,000 rockets towards Israeli cities and towns, a clear war crime. The Times goes on and says, in Israel, has subjected Gaza to such intense bombardment, killing families and flattening buildings, it probably constitutes a disproportionate use of form, also a war crime. Killed at least 197 Palestinians, including 92 women and children between last Monday and Sunday evening, according to Palestinian authorities. Hamas missiles have rained over Israeli towns and cities, sowing fear and killing at least 10 people, including 2 children. And it goes on and on. Neither side. There is not a good faith partner for the United States to talk to on either side. We still have to figure out how to enforce our will.
So in his latest op-ed for the New York Times entitled For Trump, Hamas, and Bibi, it is always January 6th. Thomas Friedman writes in part, no, Hamas and Bibi don't talk. They don't need to. They each understand what the other needs to stay in power and consciously or unconsciously behave in ways to ensure that they deliver it. The latest rerun of their long-running nasty show is happening now because both were staring at an amazing breakthrough shaping up between Israeli Jews and Israel Arab Muslims. And like the pro-Trump mob on January 6th, they wanted to destroy the possibility of political change before it could destroy them politically. Bibi and Hamas, they need each other. They understand each other. Rinse and repeat, rinse and repeat, rinse and repeat. For a brief shining moment, it looked as though a different Israeli coalition might be coming together to break that cycle. It certainly would not have made peace overnight, but it might at least have begun a different dialogue, a real dialogue among all sides. Instead, we got a January 6th moment. One that, for now, has succeeded in stopping the chance of political transformation.
And, Caddy Kay, there's always an overreaction. Of course, the United States wouldn't ask any country that had 3,000 rockets that rained down on it not to move. The question would be, though, how do you stop from getting to that point? And after it begins, how does it end? Obviously, the Iron Dome is able to deflect most of those missiles. But you look at both sides when it comes to Netanyahu and Hamas. Tom Friedman's right. Both of them were politically at risk just a week ago before this started, when it looked like Arab Israelis and some former parties that were had been in coalition with Netanyahu were going to figure out a way to come together and bring this country together instead of moving on and on from one failed election to another failed election. And then this happened. And of course, it's the radicals who win.
Yeah, it's not an extreme thing to say that this was potentially Bibi Netanyahu's get out of jail free card, right? Given that he was also facing corruption charges of his own and the possibility of a trial if he was no longer no longer head of the Israeli government. So you had this moment where it looked like you had for the first time the possibility of Israeli Jews and Arab Israelis coming together in one kind of government. And for Bibi Netanyahu, that would have been not just the end of his prime ministership, but the end of his philosophy of government in the region, and not countenanceable. And you're right as well that when you get to a cycle like this, it's incredibly hard to get out of it. And the Netanyahu government has made it very clear they're going to carry on pounding Gaza. Well, what happens in Gaza? Gaza is an area of the world that is a tiny strip of land packed to the gills with people. There is no unemployment. You can't get in. You can't get out. The only group in Gaza that manages to provide anything like services to people, water, healthcare, education, anything that functions, is Hamas. Well, the more people are killed in Gaza, the more people, they're not going to say, oh, this is Hamas's fault, which it may well be because Hamas puts its military leaders in amongst civilians. They're not going to say that. They're going to say, we need Hamas even more because we need those services even more because our country has just been destroyed and we're dealing with the rubble of buildings. So it's really hard, given the last week, to see how this doesn't end in more extremism and more bloodshed in the region. And you look back at the last 4 years of the Trump administration, and this wound was left to fester. There was a lot of focus on the Abraham Accords. I think Jared Kushner is at the moment setting up a Institute of the Abraham Accords down in Florida, touting the success of their deals with Sudan and Morocco and Bahrain and the UAE. Those countries now looking at what is happening in Israel in dismay, because this makes their accord with Israel look pretty shaky at the moment. They've had to put out statements distancing themselves from Israel because of the overwhelming use of force that is being used and the number of people in Gaza that have been killed. So it's really exacerbated not just the situation between people in Gaza and in Israel, but potentially between Israel and Israel's new allies in the region as well.
Well, which was historic when you could get Israel and Sunni Arab states together in peace accords. It's a positive thing. It's something that we should all want for that region. But the one thing we don't have right now is a good faith intermediary between us and the Palestinian leadership. Somebody that can help us go in there and get a Palestinian leader and Netanyahu together and really not ask nicely, saying this has got to end. You've got to stop killing civilians. This has got to stop. We let's start with a ceasefire. We don't have to have the Camp David Accords, but I think everybody agrees we need a ceasefire because nothing good is going to happen. And Katty, this is something I want to talk to you about. We in America, this country will always be pro-Israeli. The Israelis will always be our allies, certainly for the foreseeable future. Okay, but we take that for granted. That's not the case in Great Britain. That's not the case in France. That's not the case across the world. When images like this go across the world, all that does is further isolate Israel and the United States. It further puts us on an island as these images continue week after week after week, like they did in 2014. This is not in Israel's best interest. It's not in the United States' best interest. And it sure as hell is not in the best interest of the Palestinian people. Can you explain? And people can say, oh, I don't give a damn what they think about us in Europe. Well, you know what? We have to, for diplomatic reasons. Can you explain the impact of this on Israel's reputation across the world and ours by extension?
Yeah, I mean, remember, we are in the moment trying to renegotiate a major nuclear deal with Iran. And when I say we, I mean Europeans and the Americans. There are areas of the world where Europeans and Americans need to work together in a very urgent way, Joe. So we need to be on the same page. You're also right. Of course, European public opinion tends to be more pro-Palestinian than American public opinion. But it's been interesting to see, for the first time pretty much since I've lived here, splits emerging within the Democratic Party from the more progressive, younger wing of the Democratic Party, talking more about the Palestinians and the need to protect Palestinian rights. You don't hear that very much in American politics, a focus on Palestinians themselves and what Palestinians are going through. And I think you're hearing that because of the amount of force that the Israelis are using and the number of children in particular who have been killed in Gaza. But it doesn't help Israel in terms of its new Arab relationships, because it makes it very hard for those governments not to say so. They don't have much love lost in many of those Arab states for the Palestinian cause. They'd rather wash their hands of it. But when they're watching on their televisions children and families being bombed nightly and killed in Gaza, it's hard for them to stand on the sidelines and not condemn Israel. It makes it very difficult for them. Europeans are going to be wary of Israel at the moment, and it increases frictions as well between Europeans potentially and Americans. Tony Blinken's in Europe. It'll be interesting to see the degree to which he feels he has to weigh in on this week.
And certainly that pressure, Joe, is growing on the White House. Secretary of State, as Caddy just said, is in Europe, and he made calls yesterday from the plane to try to de-escalate this. But so far, the U.S. has not sent a high-ranking envoy to the region to try to broker the reduction in tensions and violence there. They do know, as David said earlier, their hands are somewhat tied. There's a limit to what their access is, but the calls are mounting, yes, from within the Democratic Party, for sure, but also overseas, for President Biden to do more here. He was asked just a couple of days ago if he thought Israel's response was proportionate and appropriate. And he said, certainly Israel has a right to defend itself, but there is growing concern that what we're seeing there, those images are so horrific, the president needs to step in and try to be louder here, to try to lean more on Israel, to try to rein some of this in. And this is becoming an all-consuming crisis for this White House, their first real overseas matter that they may have to jump into. And they're concerned about the ramifications for the region, particularly with the Iran deal being negotiated, renegotiated potentially in Vienna as we speak. And Joe, as a point of just personal privilege, I'd like to salute my brave colleagues at Associated Press who were in their office in Gaza and were only given minutes to evacuate before their building was leveled with an airstrike, and who were continuing to, after seeing their personal belongings, their place of refuge, turn to rubble in a matter of instants, who are still there working on the ground in borrowed office space. Hopefully they could work, guys, and please stay safe.
Incredibly traumatic, for sure.
And let's note here that none of us are naive. We understand that Hamas places themselves in those locations to attract those bombs. We understand that they hide among children and use children and women and families as human shields. We understand that. All right? We understand that. But that doesn't mean you blow through those shields and do exactly what Hamas wants you to do and play into Hamas's hands. You think they care if a leader is killed, a Hamas leader is killed, if there are images of 6, 7, 8 children being killed at the same time? No, they don't care. That's what they want Israel to do. And that's what Netanyahu is doing. He's damaging Israel's reputation, not only in Israel and not only in the region, not only across Europe, but in the United States as well. And I know that most of the world has been hostile towards Israel since 1948. That's why these tragedies are so damaging to Israel's own future, when there is no end game. And we hear Netanyahu say he's going to continue the bombing, he's going to continue the warfare, and we're going to continue to see Palestinian children and women dragged out of rubble. And we're going to continue to see Hamas missiles flying towards Jerusalem, flying towards Israel. enough. Joe Biden has the leverage. Tony Blinken has the leverage. They need to use it. And for the best interest, not just of the Palestinian people, but for the Israeli people and for the state of Israel, for the state of Israel, they need to broker a ceasefire now.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
We're going to certainly return to this, but we want to turn now to national political reporter for Axios, Jonathan Swan, who has incredible new reporting for Axios on what was happening behind the scenes at one of the tensest moments between a president and the military in modern history. The reporting is for the final episode of his Off the Rails series entitled Trump's War with His Generals. And Jonathan, I'm stunned at what I'm reading here in terms of President Trump's then attempt to address the Afghanistan situation and how he had a withdrawal plan, that's for sure. And I'll tell you about that in just a moment. But no peace plan, which is what President Biden has to deal with now. But it's this piece of paper where they had some directions scrawled out that included get us out of Afghanistan, get us out of Iraq and Syria, complete withdrawal from Germany, get us out of Africa. That was the president communicating with one of his top generals through an assistant.
Yeah, so this is November the 9th. So just to put it in context, it's 6 days after Donald Trump has lost the election. And his former body man, John McEntee, 31-year-old, former college football quarterback, was brought back into government to run the Office of Presidential Personnel. He calls up a retired Army Colonel, Douglas McGregor, a highly controversial figure who's basically been excommunicated from the military establishment, calls him into his office in the executive office building, sits him down. John McEntee has just come from the Oval Office and presents him with this piece of paper and says, this is what the president wants you to do. And it's the list that you just read out. And, you know, this is not just, okay, we've talked about Afghanistan and it's a big deal and he wanted him to get out before the end of the presidency, which to David Ignatius's credit, he was the first to report that order, which was then Trump was talked out of that order. But Trump wanted to go much broader. He was asking through McEntee to complete a withdrawal out of Germany, which would have completely reshaped America's role in the world, our alliances, our relationship with NATO. And you know, this is not some sort of incremental decision. This is, you know, he'd already ordered a drawdown from Germany. This would have been one of the most radical foreign policy decisions we've seen in modern history. And Douglas McGregor is not exactly some person who's cautious about withdrawing from the world. He's someone who has gone on Fox News and, you know, attacked congressional leadership and the Pentagon leadership as idiots and ridiculed their policies and basically gone for a completely maximalist get out of everywhere in the Middle East policy. Even Douglas McGregor was like, yeah, I don't know if we could do this before the end of the presidency. So, you know, that gives you a sense of where things were at.
We have David Ignatius with us, who you just mentioned. David has a question.
John, a great reporting. Let me ask you the question that really haunted me when I was looking at some of these same events, and that is, what was the Trump inner circle's plan if they could have somehow derailed Biden's election victory and gone on to January 20, did you look into what role these military moves might have played in their larger scheme, or were these just specific ad hoc moves in your judgment?
I never got the sense, and I've done, you know, dozens and dozens of hours of reporting on these events and talked to pretty much everyone who's had proximity to them. I don't get a sense there was a larger plan. It was Trump completely obsessed with, you know, reaching and grabbing for whatever he could to try and derail this transition, to try and overturn the results of a Democratic election and obstruct Joe Biden getting into power. And there was this sort of parallel track where he was trying to, you know, get all of this stuff done that he'd been talking about for 4 years and never actually gotten done, but would have potentially put Biden in an extremely dangerous position. And this is what General Milley and others, you know, went to the Oval and said to the president is, if you try to withdraw at this precipitous rate, Kabul could fall, all of these events could happen in Afghanistan. And they managed to talk Trump out of it. But the argument, I actually reached out to him for comment for this story, and he ended up talking to me on the phone, and he was obsessed with the equipment. The argument that seemed to resonate with Donald Trump was, let's not leave all this expensive equipment behind. So that seemed to be the thing that, you know, they always use arguments that appeal to his transactional nature. And this seemed to be the one that just barely kept America engaged in Afghanistan so that Biden could actually approach this in a deliberative fashion.
You know, you look at Donald Trump's political career and you see that he really he was transactional in most of his beliefs. He moved, you know, he changed radically on abortion. He changed radically on guns. He changed radically on all these other issues. But Caddy K, the one issue that Donald Trump has been consistent with over the decade is his bedrock belief that Americans are suckers, that we fight everybody else's war, that we spend all of our money on everybody else, that we're suckers in trade deals, that we're suckers by going into Iraq, that we're suckers for keeping, for protecting other countries. And so it's interesting, this fascinating reporting is actually the one thing, I think, where there is a consistent through line from seeing Donald Trump on the Today Show in 1988 calling us suckers for letting Japan basically buy all of the property that he wanted to buy, that through line through 2020, where he just didn't think that we should give anything to anybody or fight any wars for anybody but ourselves.
No, I mean, he never seemed to believe that there was any benefit to the U.S. from alliances or relationships that have been built up over decades, that America was only losing out. It was never going to win anything from any of those alliances. But Jonathan, America was suckers for getting into things. Take the Afghan example, for example. Did you get any reporting on whether the Afghans thought that kind of Trump was being suckered? Did they think that Trump or the generals were in the end in the driving seat?
Yeah, that's a really interesting wrinkle in the story. So there were classified NSA intercepts that were viewed by several top administration officials. And in one of these conversations, there were Afghan officials talking to each other, and they were under the strong impression that General Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the other leaders of the uniformed military were basically going to ignore Donald Trump, slow roll him, and not withdraw troops on the precipitous timeline that the president was publicly calling for. So it was certainly among senior Afghans the impression that General Milley was holding the line against Donald Trump in those final days.
All right, national political reporter for Axios, Jonathan Swan, thank you very much for coming on this morning. And still ahead on Morning Joe, after being removed from GOP leadership, Congresswoman Liz Cheney is issuing a new warning about the future of the Republican Party, saying it is headed in a dangerous direction. And what exactly do voters think of her ouster? We'll dig into brand new polling on that. You're watching Morning Joe. We'll be right back. We'll be right back.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
21 past the hour, some business news now. Today is the deadline to file your federal income taxes for 2020. If you haven't already, the IRS extended the April 15th deadline to accommodate issues amid the pandemic. Today is also the deadline to claim any refunds from the 2017 tax year. The IRS says it still has more than $1 billion in unclaimed refunds from 2017. AT&T is reportedly in advanced talks to merge its Warner Media division with Discovery. According to CNBC, the deal, which could be announced as soon as today, will combine Discovery with all of Warner Media, which will become a new publicly traded company co-owned by AT&T and Discovery shareholders. Warner Media owns cable channels such as HBO, CNN, TNT, and TBS, as well as the Warner Brothers television and film studio. Discovery has a portfolio that includes its namesake network and HDTV. The Wall Street Journal reports that Discovery chief executive David Zaslav is expected to head the new company. And retailers and restaurants are now weighing how to implement the CDC's new guidance, lifting masks for the mask mandate for those who are fully vaccinated. Walmart and Sam's Club, Starbucks, Costco, Trader Joe's, and Publix are all asking guests to follow the honor system and only unmask if they've been fully vaccinated. Disney Parks, Hershey Park, and Universal Parks have largely lifted the mask mandates for outdoors, though indoor mask wearing will still be required in certain places. Universal Studios is a part of MSNBC's parent company, NBC Universal. So you can see, Joe, it's complicated.
It's
a little complicated. Well, give it some time.
They're moving forward. I'll give it a couple of days. They're moving forward in the right direction, though.
A couple of days.
And they have the honor system, and we're at a stage now where they should follow CDC guidelines.
I know, but it takes a couple of days. I've been saying the same thing. It has to play out. Let's read now from one of Ed Luce's.
By the way, it's been a couple of days since the CDC said, return to the life you had before COVID if you've been vaccinated. That makes sense.
I don't think it's that
so
simple.
So they're all going to say that at some point, and people are going to say, oh, well, it does make a big difference if you get vaccinated in your day-to-day life.
Well, let's read now from one of Ed Luce's recent pieces for the Financial Times entitled Biden Struggles with Western Pandemic Disunity. Quote, we should be seeing peak transatlantic cooperation battling a common global threat that would seem like the ideal moment. Instead, there is growing friction. Unlike Europe, which has exported more than 100 million vaccine doses, the U.S. is still hoarding supplies. But such disparity looks trivial against mounting complaints of global vaccine apartheid. India, which desperately needs whatever supply anyone can deliver, has yet to receive part of the 60 million AstraZeneca doses held by the Biden administration. Though Biden denies there is any U.S. embargo, in practice there is. Should America's roughly 50 million or so vaccine hesitants be a bigger priority than the 5 billion adults around the world who have no choice? In the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, George W. Bush said America must fight terrorists overseas so it would not have to face them at home. That logic is well suited to today's battle against COVID-19. Unlike terrorists, the virus does not discriminate between home and abroad, neither should the West. And Ed joins us now, along with member of the New York Times editorial board, Mara Gay. It's good to have you both this morning.
So, Ed, what is the logic of the Biden administration on this front?
Well, I think it's the priority has been to vaccinate Americans first. By the way, sorry, I should just quickly thank Mika for reminding me that today is the last day to file taxes, because as a journalist, meet the deadlines, I haven't yet filed my taxes. Thank you for that reminder.
Gotta get it done.
You do. I do. Priority, I think, has been to get America vaccinated and then step up assistance to the world. But the pandemic, the virus, is not respecting that kind of sequencing. And we're seeing these new variants develop in places like India and also leave places like India. In Britain right now, the Indian double mutant variant, scariant, as some people call it, is already complicating plans to lift restrictions. Britain's behind where the CDC has just arrived at last week. And it looks like it's probably going to remain behind the CDC, even though Britain is actually ahead in terms of how many people it's vaccinated. So there is a warning there for Biden that all the great things that are happening, namely the rapid vaccine rollout, the economic recovery that is based on that, and the good poll numbers that Biden is experiencing, all of this could very quickly be jeopardized by the arrival of more tricky variants in American circulation, if you like. And so the priority of defeating the global, of having a global vaccine rollout, isn't just some foreign policy or global humanitarian instinct. It's an essential part of his domestic plans. He's got to merge the two. And some of that is about building a common position here with the Europeans, which at the moment is very much lacking. They're not seeing eye to eye, for example, on Biden's, I think, very necessary proposition of lifting the patents, of waiving patents on these vaccines.
Yeah, David Ignatius has a question. David.
Ed, this image of American hoarding and selfishness is really unattractive. But I'm reminded of what you always hear on airlines when we fly on them, which is be sure to apply your own oxygen mask before attempting to assist others. And I'm reminded of that because unless the United States vaccinates its own population, our ability to be active as a country, to buy the world's goods, to be outward leaning, to make a difference in the world is going to be limited, isn't it?
That's very true. But I think America has the resources to do all of the above. It can be doing both at the same time. Remember, countries like India and in Africa and Latin America, they don't have the dollar. They can't afford simply to lock down the economy and pay their people to stay at home. So their only option is to vaccinate people quick, is to kill this virus. And it's just as much in our interests, too, because they are essentially petri dishes for the development of new variants that will assuredly not respect U.S. immigration and customs. It'll come straight into this country and test the efficacy of our vaccines. So when you think of what the CDC did last Thursday, this rather surprising move of saying, of switching to an honor system, I would be a little bit worried about that in the context of this fall of the CDC then turning around and saying, look, you've got to put them back on again because we've got new variants to deal with and we don't know whether our vaccines can cope with them. So I think there's a big sequencing and messaging problem here. But the way to deal with it is to vaccinate the world, and America has the resources.
And Mara Gay, I mean, that's really the to David's point, the fine balance for President Biden, who's dealing with one issue, and that is our appearance around the world, and certainly hoarding vaccines is not a good look. At the same time, we have such radical vaccine hesitancy that is politically motivated and pushed on Facebook and through the sort of the whole Trump population. And that could change very quickly to he sent our vaccines away. I mean, overnight. And yet we want this country to continue to work toward herd immunity. We need people to get vaccines.
That's right. We really need to walk and chew gum here, I think. But one thing to consider is that even though vaccine hesitancy is very real, clearly, and for several reasons across several demographic groups across the United States, there is also a significant population of Americans who have not been able to access a vaccine for various reasons. In New York, for example, our reporting is clear that some of the hardest to reach groups in the city tend to be older New Yorkers, for example, who are Black or Latino, who live at home, are homebound, folks like that, folks who are undocumented, who are working much of the day, who can't access sites at certain times. So we really do need to, we've kind of done the lower hanging fruit, so to speak, people who want to get vaccinated, people who have the ability to easily take a day off from work and go get vaccinated. Now we really need to do the hard work in the United States of public health messaging to encourage people to get the vaccine. At the same time, we need to be knocking on doors, making it extremely easy for those with busy lives and hardships to get vaccinated. And I think until we've done that work, we won't really know what the true population of people who refuse to get the vaccine is. But at the same time, we do need to be generating more vaccines and sending them wherever the need is, because those variants will bounce right back at us. And I can tell you as a New Yorker, I imagine they will be here first. So it's just something to consider. I mean, everybody's talking about this fun summer ahead, and that's wonderful, but this is not over.
Correct. Ed Luce, thank you so much for being on with us this morning. And coming up, get your taxes done. Coming up, when did the U.S. government and the Pentagon start taking the possibility of UFOs seriously? That reporting is next. Morning Joe's coming right back.
When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.